in addition to 71,000 wounded. The Israeli Zionists considered these massacres against Arabs, including Palestinians, as one of the pillars of the Israeli entity deterrence theory. Through a policy of terror and intimidation, the dream of building this Hebrew state is realized.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hassan Hijazi, expert in Zionist affairs. A pleasure for having you with us, Mr. Hassan. Now, Netanyahu faces an inescapable dilemma. His government is threatened with collapse whether it accepts or rejects any formula proposed by the resistance in Palestine. Consequently, early elections in Zionist Israel are highly likely at the moment in the upcoming months, which will inevitably lead to Netanyahu's disappearance from all the Zionist political scene. But is that enough to demote the risk on Gaza and the West Bank? Or is the problem not only Netanyahu and his coalition?
Benjamin Netanyahu undoubtedly plays a fundamental role at this level in prolonging the war. This issue is a fundamental issue and a crucial knot in not stopping this battle. Netanyahu's staying in power is intertwined with the continuation of the fighting. If things head towards early elections and Netanyahu is forced out of power through the ballot boxes, this issue may affect the shape and course of the battle. Netanyahu is leading a battle for his political life at this level, and he fully realizes that the end of the war will lead him to be held accountable and tried. This issue will have decisive repercussions on his fate and his political trajectory. From this perspective, undoubtedly, early elections, if held during the war, will have significant implications at this level. Even though the other leaders still adhere to the issue of the battle's objectives and the elimination of Hamas, and they may align with the direction supported by the American administration regarding the exit from the war and the search for political solutions through agreement with the Palestinians on a formula for the next phase of the war. This is what Netanyahu currently rejects. From this perspective, Netanyahu may play a fundamental and decisive role at this level, whereby the issue of the battle's continuation is linked to his staying in power, while if he leaves this authority, alternatives and formulas may already be found through which the new authority can find ways to end the war and claim that it has achieved at least part of the objectives and goals it was seeking.
But this puts it at a very important question, which is one of the leading Zionist national security theories, which has always been to implement massacres in the arenas of their enemies and their adversaries, especially among civilians, in order to instill the element of terror, of being intimidated in the mind and consciousness of the people that they are fighting. They have succeeded in doing so, sadly, with an unprecedented scale of genocide in Gaza over the past 6 months. But do you think that this is what is considered a success inside of the Zionist entity community, if I may, despite the fact that they know that the objectives set by the regime were never met?
This issue relates to what the occupation terms deterrence in Zionist military theory, which dictates causing comprehensive destruction and notifying the other party that it will pay unbearable prices and cannot coexist with it if it chooses to confront the Zionist entity. From this perspective, the occupation sought to commit this enormous level of massacres and this high level of killing, destruction, and displacement of the Palestinian people. However, at this level, the occupation may have collided, despite the horror of the scenes in terms of human losses and destruction in Palestinian buildings and infrastructure. It collided with a state of resilience, endurance, and patience that the Palestinian people demonstrated in the face of this massive and terrifying massacre. From this perspective, Palestinians managed to cope with this level of fighting, and the matter was extremely painful, but their resilience on the ground, enduring the environment, and the resistance fighters' resilience prevented the occupation from achieving what the Zionist entity and Benjamin Netanyahu specifically called a decisive and final victory. Netanyahu has set a fundamental condition that cannot be achieved in any way, even in the view of various circles within the occupation entity, because he will not be able to eliminate Palestinian resistance, which continues to fight on all fronts despite 6 months passing since the battle. This issue confirms that the Zionist strategy has failed and that the theory of victory that Benjamin Netanyahu talks about will remain distant, and that the Palestinians have a long breath to continue fighting and are willing to make more sacrifices, and they will not raise the white flag, as many Zionist experts claim. This confirms that the occupation will not dream or taste the sweetness of victory in facing the Palestinians, but will encounter resistance in its various forms everywhere. We must take, for example, what happened in Al-Shifa Hospital after the occupation entered it in the previous period and claimed to have ended its work there. Now, it returns to this place to face persistent resistance and relentless fighting, indicating that the military operations, in the manner pursued by the occupation and utilizing all military capabilities and energies at its disposal, did not achieve its objectives, and that the victory Netanyahu talks about will be very distant.
Well, it is worth noting here that Benjamin Netanyahu has remained throughout his years in power since 1993, working and maneuvering to achieve two main goals for the Zionist entity. One, completely liquidating the Palestinian cause, and two, integrating Zionist Israel with the region by normalization at the same time, doing both goals at the same time. He always believed, and he still, by the way, believes that he could do that, that he is the only one capable of actually achieving those two goals. However, after Gaza 2023-2024, what do you think the legacy of Netanyahu will be after he gets either ousted or removed from power?
The reality of the normalization project, sponsored by the administrations of former President Donald Trump and current President Joe Biden, aligns perfectly with Benjamin Netanyahu's vision, who seeks to gain relations with Arab states in the surrounding region and the Gulf. But at the same time, he does not want to offer anything to the Palestinians. Netanyahu clearly adopted this theory and stated that we will go for settlement and normalization with the Arabs, leaving the Palestinians behind so that they eventually have no choice but to follow us and accept the conditions we offer. Netanyahu's theory now clearly states that he does not want to recognize any form of authority for the Palestinians or any form of sovereignty over any geographic area, neither in the West Bank nor in Gaza. Yet he aspires to continue the path of normalization with the Arabs. This issue will remain on the table in the future stage. Some Arab parties, led by Saudi Arabia, have expressed their rejection of this principle and stated that they will not accept normalization unless the Palestinians obtain something. This issue cannot be accepted by the Arab public opinion in any way that fully harmonizes with Netanyahu's direction at this level. Netanyahu may have put the occupation and this entity on this path into crisis in the next stage because the level of confrontation that generated this kind of crime and Zionist destruction and this image of this entity at the level of Arab and Islamic public opinion will create a significant obstacle for any Arab state that may resort to normalization. After this massive massacre, it might be difficult at this level unless a power within the occupation entity accepts making concessions. However, it seems that we are now seeing the political level moving towards more right-wing extremism and racism, as the Knesset rejected recognizing any form of Palestinian state last month. This confirms that Benjamin Netanyahu has left extremist marks on Zionist policy that will not serve the occupation in the long run, but rather increase its isolation and prevent it from achieving what is called integration at the regional level.
Well, Mr. Hassan Hijazi, expert in Zionist affairs, I want to thank you very much for your time and contribution discussing with us an end of an era for a war criminal, a genocidal war criminal like Benjamin Netanyahu. Thank you for your time and effort, ladies and gents. Thank you. Please stay tuned as we bring you the latest from West Asia right here on the Mideast Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
As the Zionist regime's invasion of Gaza enters its 6th month, the impact on Palestinian children has been devastating. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, UN agencies report that, following the Zionist regime's invasion of Gaza, at least 17,000 Palestinian children have been orphaned or separated from relatives, and 1 in 6 children under the age of 2 are acutely malnourished. The Health Ministry in Gaza reported that 23 children died from malnutrition and dehydration in recent weeks. At least 32,000 people killed in Gaza, over 13,000 are children. The UN has warned that nearly 580,000 Palestinians, a quarter of Gaza's population, are one step away from famine. There are many such horrible recollections. The psychological trauma rooted in the ravages of war are scars that last a lifetime for children. The Zionist regime continues to block humanitarian aid from reaching Palestinians in Gaza and has attacked Palestinians attempting to receive aid. The last day of February witnessed Israeli regime forces massacring over 100 unarmed Palestinians, queuing for flour and humanitarian assistance. 3 days later, the Zionist regime killed 9 Palestinian civilians in line for flour in 2 separate attacks. Having already vetoed 3 UN Security Council resolutions for a ceasefire, the Biden administration also blocked a statement that condemned the flour bag massacre, as it did not have all the facts yet on the ground. Even though Washington has supplied the Zionist regime military with massive quantities of munitions and political cover, it has consistently claimed that it is unable to influence Israeli regime policy. Instead, the Biden administration initiated airdrops of ready meals into Rafah. The airdrops are not even close to sufficient considering the dire needs of the population. And on March 8, the falling crates killed 5 people, including 2 children, when a parachute or parachutes failed to open. Biden's proposed temporary port will take weeks to complete as disease and malnourishment grow. Meanwhile, the child killer regime of Israel has continued its campaign and is employing American weapons. As the first aid drops were delivered, an Israeli drone strike targeted Palestinians huddling in tents outside Rafah's Emirati hospital. At least 11 civilians, including children and 2 health workers, were killed, and at least 50 people were injured. For 5 months, the Biden administration has defended Israel's actions and offered only muted criticism. Washington has remained steadfast in its support, despite the overwhelming evidence of war crimes, including the determination by the International Court of Justice of a genocide. Spokespersons for the White House, State Department, and National Security Council, as well as President Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken, have repeatedly dismissed or diminished reports by the United Nations, journalists, and humanitarian organizations of the humanitarian catastrophe that has been live-streamed to a horrified global audience. Even after the flour bag massacre, NSC spokesman John Kirby insisted that Israel has tried to help with the delivery of humanitarian assistance, yet a handful of Israeli protesters have been successful in blocking aid trucks from entering Gaza. The carnival-like atmosphere of these Israeli protesters at the border crossing has occurred in full view of international media as well as the Zionist regime's military. The child killer regime of Israel has also prevented basic necessities from entering Gaza and contributed to the pain and suffering of Palestinian children. CNN has reported that maternity kits, sleeping bags and equipments have been barred from entering Gaza. Anesthetics, oxygen cylinders and crutches are also on the list of rejected items. The shocking scenes of children undergoing surgical procedures and amputations without anesthesia have now become routine, as has the acronym WCNSF for Wounded Child with No Surviving Family. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, 6 November, warning that Gaza was becoming a graveyard for children, has been realized. Hend Rajab, a 6-year-old girl, who called begging for help after the Zionist regime troops targeted the car in which she and her family were traveling, was killed after a long wait along with the paramedics who went to save her. Infants like 45-day-old Mahmoud Fatou, who died due to severe dehydration and malnutrition, or Ahmad, a child who was rescued after 9 days under the rubble, a skeleton, or Talin, 10, who recognize her mother's body by the hair. And there are countless stories of mothers who held their children in arms when they took their last breath. And this is only a partial telling. There are thousands of others whose stories we don't know. With thousands still buried under the rubble, the stories of many of the dead children may never be told. Yet the Biden administration repeatedly insists it needs more evidence before it can condemn or criticize the Zionist regime's actions, standards it has not applied to Palestinians or UN agencies or the ICJ. Children in Gaza have suffered the loss of their closest family members, in many cases their parents, siblings, grandparents, and other relatives. Their homes and schools have been destroyed, their neighbors killed or displaced. Their books and toys have been lost, their pets have been killed, their favorite park has been razed. Under constant bombardment, the Palestinian children are still grappling with the greatest challenges of siege, destruction, displacement, and starvation. These challenges will only increase in the weeks and months after the fighting ends. And the children will never forgive the silence and complicity of Western regimes who supported the Zionist regime's actions.
Covering Islam.
The story of Tawheed is not limited to the creation of the world or oneness of God. Another important aspect of Tawheed is that we have to worship the one and only God. But why should we worship God? What is the purpose of worship? Why should we worship a God who does not benefit from our worshiping? And why is worshiping anything beside or in association with God the greatest sin according to the Quran? Man is a worshipping being and cannot be free from worship in one form or another. If we do not worship God, we worship other things, even including our ideas, our aspirations, or our desires. The moment we cease to worship, our life is disrupted.
The word in Arabic for worship is aliha, which is used in the phrase la ilaha illallah. The word aliha actually means a number of things. It means to worship. It also means to be obsessed with. It also means to rely on someone in time of need. It also means to be in love with someone. It also means, continuing the idea of obsession, to not be able to think of anyone else. To feel or to miss someone intensely when they're not present. And so when we say La ilaha illallah, we are saying there's no one worthy of worship, or of love, of obsession, of reliance. No one worthy of me turning to them in time of desperation and need other than Allah.
Tawheed in worship is one of the most important aspects of Tawheed. For it's not a matter of belief anymore, but a matter of action as well. It shows how committed one is in their faith. It is the manifestation of the soul and heart of a believer in their practice.
Worship in action includes that your intention, you have to have ikhlas, which means pure sincerity for the sake of God. Not your ego, not to please others, not to please society, but to please the one that created you.
Worship is to adorn, to praise, and to humble oneself towards the object of worship. The Quran states that some people take their fleeting desires as the objects of their worship.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. أفرأيت من اتخذ إلهه هوا. Have you seen the one who takes his own base desire as his Lord? So associating partners to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not only worshipping an idol. The individual might worship his own lower self. When I'm obeying other than Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that can be my nafs. That itself is a form of shirk. As we know, we have two different types of shirk. The first type is shirk al-khafi. Shirk al-khafi is the hidden shirk. And the second type is shirk al-jali. It is the apparent one. The apparent one is the person in the temple worshipping, if he's truly worshipping the idol. But the khafi one, the hidden one, the minor shirk, is me taking my lower desire, taking the power, taking the position, taking my wealth as my Lord. And both of these types of shirk takes me to destruction, because it's taking me away from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
All human beings are bound to worship something. It is in our nature to worship. The only thing is, are we picking the right authority, or the Quranic word is ilah, or God, to worship? Quran actually details a few false gods. For example, Hawa, the god of desire. So if we were to become ibad, or servants of desire, what would happen to us? We would be destroyed. We would have self-destruction. We would not be able to live our lives in the best way possible. So it is indeed our nature to worship something, and our best interest to worship Allah.
You have people who are free of the worship of God, who free themselves of the worship of the Creator. However, that's not to say that it's not replaced by the worship of something else. So you see people who don't worship God end up worshiping earthly pleasures, they end up worshipping money or power, they end up having addictions which become like a kind of worship because there is such a strong dependence on them. So man can free himself of worship of God's, man can free himself of God's worship simply because he has the free will to do so. However, that's not to say that it's a choice without consequence.
In our day-to-day experience, we can see how sometimes we are humbled to and infatuated by our desires. This is because realizing those desires is very important to man. And thus, he is prepared to humble himself before anything that may help him to bring about what he wants and to realize his desires. And this is probably how idol worshiping came about.
Idol worship is an aberration of the heart and mind. Idol worship is essentially the ego, because I think all idol worship stems from self-worship. Because there's going to be an element where you're going to be worshipping your ego, because your ego is that veil that prevents you from seeing the truth.
People used to worship idols because they thought they controlled the sources of what they sought. If they wanted a child or money or victory or good harvest, there was a god for each of them who could fulfill their need. It was sheer material need which made them to turn to God. And since God was so transcendent, they sought more immediate deities to talk to.
Many people find it very difficult to understand a transcendental God, a God that is everywhere, but at the same time so far away from us, a God who's all-powerful, but we're so impotent, a God who is living everywhere, but we will die. A God who is powerful to do anything, yet we can struggle to do anything. When there is that very big gap between where we are and where God is, there feels that there needs to be some sort of intermediary to get there. And that is where this idea of idol worship happens. And the idea that they can worship someone who acts as a mechanism to get to the purest God.
The big question is, why has God placed this sense of worship in man? Why are we instructed to worship him? Is he in need of us worshiping him?
Well, I would never want to worship a God that actually benefits from me. That would mean God is not God anymore. It means he's weak, he's needy. God's name is the free. Al-Ghani, he's free, he's independent, he's self-subsisting. That deserves to be worshipped.
Fundamental to the conception of God in Islam and in the Quran is that he is independent. He is needless. Huwa al-ghani. The verse continues, wa antum al-fuqaraa. You are the needy. You are the dependent. So God does not need our worship whatsoever.
Wa ma khalaqtu al-jinna wal-insa illa liya'budun. How should we interpret this verse in the Quran, which states that God has not created jinn and human being, but to worship him?
Some people misunderstand this ayah and think God just wants us to just be praying to him all the time and do nothing else, just pray, because we have no other purpose in life. Actually, all the other things, like, it's the same God who said, وَجَعَلْنَا لَكُمْ فِيهَا مَعَايِشْ. He put on the earth things for you to live well. He wants you to live well in this world. He wants you to dress well, eat well, sleep well, have a nice family, enjoy yourselves. He wants those things for you. And guess what? When you do them, you are actually fulfilling a command of Allah by utilizing the things he made for you.
People sometimes make objections as to why, if God does exist, he needs to be worshipped. Surely if God exists, he is free of any such need. Why do we have such a needy God who needs to be constantly told that he's right, that needs to be constantly told that he's great? However, really the truth is that, of course, God doesn't need to be worshipped at all. And we don't worship God because it is in any way adding to his being or taking away from it if we are not worshiping him. We worship God because we need to worship God, because we need to have a sense of grounding and a sense of direction. We worship God as a reminder of who put us on this earth, as a reminder of why we are here, and as a reminder of where we will ultimately end up. If we didn't remind ourselves of God and of his existence every single day, we would very soon forget. And then where would we be? We would be completely lost.
Thus, the only meaning that we can imagine for this verse is that worship brings us closer to him. And by him, we mean the absolute perfection.
If I want to get closer to perfection, or if I want to become perfect myself, I need to take this perfection or these attributes from the source of perfection.
Worshipping God is nothing to do with him requiring it. God is considered to be Ghani. He is needless of any of our worship. But at the same time, it is us who need that worship. We need this opportunity to really excel in this life. Why? Because that will help us in the hereafter, and it will help other people in this world. And that's the core essence of why we are here. We need to have this opportunity to excel.
So what is the purpose in this worship? The purpose in this worship is nothing more than for humankind's benefit, to help humankind move towards those pinnacles of existence and to take on those godlike qualities in their life.
The famous verse which states that God only created man and jinn to worship him clearly states that the aim of the creation is the journey towards God. And let's be reminded that God is the source of all perfection. Hence, the conclusion is this life is about worshipping him, i.e. is about taking this journey towards perfection.
There remains another essential question here. How should we worship God? Are rituals enough as worship?
Ritual performance is nothing if it isn't a means towards godliness and goodliness. And we see this throughout the Quran. Worship in its truest sense is servitude towards God, to become as God would like one to be. This isn't done through the performance of any ritual. Rituals are purely instrumental.
Worship means obedience. Worship means submission to the will of God. Worship does not mean that you should constantly sit in the direction of Mecca and continue to pray and pray and pray. As long as you're living your life according to the will of God and you're not disobeying, every single breath that you're taking is worship.
Too often we talk about worship solely in terms of ritual. We talk about worship solely in terms of doing things. Whereas worship in itself is the remembrance of God as God should be remembered. It is the remembrance of God in a way that reminds us of his greatness. And if what we are doing, whatever ritual we are performing, is not reminding us of the greatness of God, then really it is not an act of worship, it is mere ritual.
In other words, anything we do in this world in remembrance, love, and obedience of God can be regarded as an act of worship.
To summarize it is to love God, to obey him, and to worship him. And that translates in many things. Praying 5 times a day, doing dhikr, which is the remembrance of God. Actually being in service to your fellow human beings is also a form of worship if you're doing it for the sake of God. And that's worship in action in a way, when you're doing actions like serving others and giving acts of charity. Because we believe that acts of worship, but the only true worship if you do it for the sake of God.
Worship is an evolving process. And when one worships with an understanding of what God is, one always has to work towards perfection.
So our ritual fasts and prayers are not the only acts of worship. Our love for our family and relatives, any help extended to fellow human beings, to win bread for our dependents, could as well be regarded as acts of worship.
A vicarious remembrance. Look at the signs. Look at what is around you. And you will get the feeling that he is with you even though you don't see him. And the final step, which is excellence, al-ihsan, is to worship him as if you are seeing him. But how? Out of love. In kuntum tuhibbun Allah. Worshipping is to love, is not only to abide by the rules. You abide by the rules because you love. And you show your love because you abide by the rules. So it's a virtuous cycle, and this is the meaning of worshipping.
Apart from the acts we offer as worship, worship has an essence. Its essence is based on placing one's hope and fear in God alone.
Tawheed in worship means that the type of humility, obedience, fear and hope offered to God should not be offered to anyone and anything else. This is the path to man's perfection because it emancipates human heart and soul from all other types of worship.
Idol worshipping is considered a great sin, and the reason for this is because the very feeling instilled in man to bring him closer to God is diverted to leave him further away from God.
When you have a relationship with the one who is all perfect, because that's who he is, and he is the most beautiful, and he's the most perfect, and he's the most loving, then you want to emulate those qualities in your life. You want life around you to be more and more beautiful. You want more and more love in your life. You want more and more, you know, better and better things in your life. Because at the end of the day, this quest will come to a conclusion when you finally meet him and you actually get to see perfection itself.
But should we fear God or love him? Are fear and love compatible with each other? The Quran actually advises us that at the same time that we love God, we have to fear him as well. And different experiences of fear are mentioned in the Quran, or different levels of fear. Taqwa, khashya, shafaqa, rahba are but some examples.
The relationship between fear and love is one which is seen as a dynamic in Islam, okay, and often portrayed as such. They can be two sides of the same coin, okay, and fear and love are not wholly incompatible. Absolutely not are they wholly incompatible. Having said that, the predominant ethos of the Quran is one of love, okay, as is encapsulated in that repeated reference to God as being Rahman and being Rahim, the unqualified giver.
Every relationship comes with love and fear. Why is it so hard to understand with God? We have to love him and we have to be afraid that he might be upset about something. But if your relationship in this world, if your relationship is only love and you're never afraid, like if I think about my wife, yeah, I love her, but I'm never afraid of disappointing her. I'm never worried about saying something that might hurt her feelings. I might think the relationship is perfect, but she might actually think that I don't care about her anymore. If my relationship with her is only about fear, oh my God, she's going to get angry. If I say something, she's going to get so mad, right? Then over time, I will lose all love for her. All that's left is fear.
We have to start with loving him. Once we base our understanding on rationality, then you cannot but love him. Fear, of course, there are consequences to our decisions. These consequences can be consequences between us and God or things that affect people around us. Punishments is part of the equation.
faithless parts of the existence. You take the wrong decision. The Quran states is that not that God has ascribed certain punishments to this wrong decision. Your wrong decision itself in reality has these negative consequences.
Taqwa is the beginning of all those different levels of fear, and it is the beginning of worship. It is faith put to application. It is fear of losing God's support and trying to win His favor. But our fear of God is not purely for the consequences. It is sometimes an awesome experience of His greatness.
Khashya is a fear as a result of knowledge and leads to action. It is when you know the greatness and the magnitude of what you fear, and as a result, you have reverence of it. There is another type of fear mentioned in the Holy Quran, which is referred to as rahb. Rahb is the kind of a fear that makes you very alert, very careful, and does not let you relax. It is like type of fear that the students have during exam time. They're careful, they're restless, and they're concerned about their passing. It is also fear that you're afraid that you'll disappoint the one you love. The final type of fear which is mentioned is shafaqa. Shafaqa is the fear that some harm will come to a person you love. It is that type of fear. It is a fear that is mixed with love, such as the love of a mother for her children. She is fearful out of love for them.
If worshipping God is so important for the perfection of man, what happens if it is directed to concepts, objects, or persons other than God?
It's a divergence from the straight path. Does it have consequences? It does. Because we are meant to direct our thoughts and our actions with the unlimited being that is God. Once we attach ourselves to a limited form of existence, i.e. any form of an idol, because he's limited, our journey towards perfection will be very limited and very short, and it will hinder our progress towards perfection. So to free ourselves and to go back on the straight path to that endless journey towards the absolute perfection, we need to be free from idol worshipping and direct this energy and this fellowship to God and God only.
Well, when you worship your own desires, for example, avid materialistic culture, avid individualism, you have social breakdown and decay. If you look at the Children's Society report that was published in 2009, it came to the conclusion that our societies are breaking down because of what? Avid, excessive individualism. What's in it for me? I'm all right, Jack. And that, in a way, is worshipping the ego, is worshipping a false god. So it does have negative consequences in society, definitely.
Associating partners with God is an utter misjudgment. Now, that's because Allah is the reality, and what He invokes besides Him is nullity. Chapter 22, verse 62, He is the only source of good, perfection, or existence. This implies those who evoke others besides Him are under an illusion.
But fear is only one leg of worship. The other very important component of worship is hope. Hope to go closer to God and to be included in His favor and mercy. Hope to be good enough to be loved by God and to be granted His love in our hearts. It's only through these two components of fear and hope that the true worship is realized. And that is something that should be offered only to God and no one but God. In fact, it is through worshipping God that we can expand and develop our God-given faculties. Associating partners with God would not only stop that process, but it is showing ingratitude towards our Creator. It is only by acknowledging that all beauty comes from God and all praise is due to Him that man can be accomplished. Join me in the next episode of Discovering Islam to talk more about the creation of man. Until then, peace be with you.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Journalists in Western corporate and so-called public media, whether it is the BBC, CBC, CNN, the New York Times, or the Washington Post, know exactly what is happening in Gaza. They know there is a genocide because they see the same images the rest of us see, filmed by brave Palestinian journalists and ordinary citizens. They all know what the judges of the International Court of Justice decided. And yet, these truths are kept out of US and European media. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Mark Esper, current CNN Global Affairs analyst and former defense secretary for President Donald Trump, lasting all of 16 months in the position, presented erroneous information last week to CNN viewers. On February 29th, CNN anchor John Berman asked him about what has become known as the Flower Bag Massacre. He said, "We've just seen in the reporting out of Gaza maybe 100 people killed while waiting for aid. The humanitarian situation in Gaza, how much of a threat is that to hopes for peace there, to hopes for Israel to achieve what they want to achieve?" Setting aside Berman's apparent frustration at the starvation interfering with the Zionist regime's devastating onslaught in Gaza, Esper's answer bears close examination. Esper acknowledged that Israel has a responsibility under international humanitarian law to provide food and aid to the civilians in Gaza, but it was downhill from there. He quickly shifted to pure speculation, propaganda for the American viewer. He claimed, "There are concerns, of course, have been for many years, that food aid coming in is rife with you. You know, arms and ammunition for Hamas, and that maybe Hamas is also pilfering it. Reports, early reports from this incident are maybe that that was happening and then Israel opened fire or maybe a stampede happened." It's not clear what Esper is trying to convey to the viewer. Is he saying that the resistance group Hamas was trying to smuggle in arms and ammunition when the Zionist regime forces opened fire and killed 112 Palestinians while injuring another 760, according to the Gaza Health Ministry? If so, there has been zero evidence presented of arms smuggling in that convoy. The Zionist regime, after all, is checking everything trucked into Gaza. Alternatively, he may only be suggesting that the resistance group Hamas was pilfering the aid. Similarly, no evidence of Hamas taking that aid has been presented. As for desperate people being trampled along with deadly Israeli regime fire, the occupying power starving Palestinians would be responsible for both. Esper, unsurprisingly, says nothing about the Zionist regime's genocidal policies in the Gaza Strip. Perhaps he doesn't believe it, but as an analyst, he should note the International Court of Justice views this as a genocide. There is not a word from him in the op-ed about the consequences of this policy for over 12,500 Palestinian children killed by the Israeli regime attack. Nor does he mention the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians facing starvation, with 15 Palestinian children now dead of dehydration and malnutrition, as even CNN is hesitantly reporting. Esper further fails to raise the importance of prosecuting the Zionist regime perpetrators of this genocide. Of course, he says nothing about dismantling the apartheid Israeli regime and replacing it with a regime securing equal rights for all, much as he was done in Jim Crow American South and apartheid South Africa. Deeper detail about the unequal reality facing Palestinians is not to be routinely broached at CNN. Instead, CNN has presented calls of "From the River to the Sea, Palestine Will Be Free" as anti-Semitic. Presumably, CNN also views equal rights in the context of one state as anti-Semitic. The New York Times, often quick to present the Zionist regime's position, did not entirely side with Esper's biased speculation about the convoy. They presented the views of witnesses, health officials, and the Zionist regime's military. Readers were advised, quote, "Witnesses described extensive shooting by Israeli forces amid widespread panic, and doctors at Gazan hospitals said that most of those killed and injured were by gunfire. Others were crushed under trucks, frantically trying to escape." Witnesses said the Gazan health officials called it a massacre, unquote. The authors, Aaron Boxerman and Adam Raskin, who months ago was critical of Al Jazeera and its Gaza bureau chief, Wael Tahtu, just days after Israeli fire killed his wife, 16-year-old son, and 6-year-old daughter, did dutifully note that the Zionist regime military had claimed its troops fired after individuals in the crowd approached them in a manner which endangered them. They write that the military attributed most of the deaths to a crush as hungry Palestinians sought to seize the cargo. A different New York Times article by Heba Yazbek and Boxerman cited Israeli military spokesperson Daniel Hagari as claiming Israeli troops shot in the air before firing only in the face of danger when the mob moved in a manner which endangered them. A CNN.com article cites Hagari as saying the tanks that were there to secure the convoy sees the Gazan being trampled and cautiously tries to disperse the mob with a few warning shots, unquote. The article also quotes Hagari as stating, "I think as a military man, they were backing up securely, risking their own lives, not shooting at the mob," unquote. Esper's ongoing affinity for a genocidal apartheid army, he hasn't tweeted out any acknowledgement of error, is made all the more clear by the sort of rhetoric coming from the Zionist regime's military spokesperson, who on at least 3 occasions dismisses starving people as a mob. For Esper, it's a stampede. That same morning of February 29th, CNN anchor Kate Bolden interviewed New York Governor Katie Hochul. Bolden didn't ask one question about Hochul's genocidal comment earlier in the month to the United Jewish Appeal Federation of Jewish Philanthropies of New York, Incorporation. The CNN anchor also did not respond to the Electronic Intifada's inquiry about the absence of a question about Hochul's pushing genocide in Gaza. Hochul had declared, "If Canada someday ever attacked Buffalo, I'm sorry, my friends, there would be no Canada the next day." Her implicit endorsement of a genocide wiping out Gaza and Canada was met with laughter rather than outrage from the audience attending the event. Hochul then added, clearly speaking of Gaza and her Canada, hypothetical, quote, "That's a natural reaction. You have a right to defend yourself and to make sure it never happens again," unquote. She issued an apology the next day, but the damage was done. Hochul admitted to an inappropriate analogy, and according to New York Times, she apologized for her poor choice of words. She did not apologize to the Palestinian children her words helped to kill. Touting genocide is now casually dismissed as poor word choice, and starving people are a mob. American and Zionist officials have a lot to answer for if the International Court of Justice takes up its job responsibly.
Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Arash, located in the north of the Persian Gulf in Bushehr province, is a gas and oil field jointly owned by Iran and Kuwait. Over the past 60 years, both countries have acknowledged each other's rights to a share of the significant resources in the field. Surprisingly enough, the Supreme Council of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council has recently issued a statement claiming that only Kuwait and Saudi Arabia have sovereign rights over the field, raising Tehran ire. The Islamic Republic of Iran has reiterated that it cannot stand any violation of its national sovereignty and territorial integrity. It's just another tension underway in West Asia. What's the significance of Arash gas and oil field? What is Kuwait's position? What is Tehran's position? Why is Saudi Arabia engaged in this dispute out of the blue? Has there been any attempt to reach a deal? And if yes, why hasn't it borne any fruit? These and more on this edition of Iran Today. The offshore field known as Arash in Iran and Doreh in Kuwait has long been a source of contention between these two countries, grabbing headlines from time to time. فرزین سوادکوهی است an energy journalist based in Tehran.
به نظر اومد که میدان مهمی میتونه باشه به لحاظ اقتصادی برای ما.
The Arash field with its significant potential benefits for Iran, Kuwait and Saudi Arabia has yet to be developed due to various factors. Following the Islamic Revolution's victory, Iran attempted to initiate the development process. However, unforeseen circumstances continually halted progress. One of the primary obstacles was the ongoing disagreement